This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. They're good at bread. They're good at snails. At wine, there is a chance that they may be the very best, those folks who live in France. But does a Frenchman or Frenchwoman ever get to say, I've won my country's tournament? Well, this could be the day. Joining me now from the French Open to speculate on that possibility and various other matters related to the tournament is Bud Collins, who writes about tennis for the Boston Globe. Welcome back to Only a Game, Bud.
Thank you, Bill.
I'm going to start by asking you about Mary Pierce. She is certainly sufficiently French to have a large following in France, and she stands poised on the brink of winning the French Open for the second time. Any worry that her road to the final has been too easy to provide an adequate tune-up?
No, I don't think so. She had to beat the number one player in the world, Lindsay Davenport, and she beat her very badly. She had a rather difficult time with Patty Schnieder, who fought off 10 match points. But I think Mary is looking better than she ever has. I'm not sure she can beat Justine Henin-Ardenne, the Belgian, because she's looking awfully good, and I think she's going to return to number one in the game. But the crowd will be with Mary. There'll be 15,000 people screaming for her at every moment. She's not in as good shape as she might be against anyone else, however, because Henin is French-speaking as well, and she has her fans here, too.
Well, it's rather remarkable that Justine Henin-Ardenne is upright and mobile after what she's gone through over the past year or so, isn't it?
Well, it is, really. She's had several illnesses that I can't pronounce. She has hurt her knee badly in Australia just before she was ready to defend her title, didn't play in the tournament, and she wobbled around for almost a year, and recently, however, she has won 23 straight matches. Mm-hmm. She has such a complete game. Now, what's going to happen? And I talked to Mary Pierce this morning. She knows that she plays very slowly, very deliberately. I remember when she beat Steffi Graf here in 1994. She was using about a minute between points, and the French officials didn't care at all. She said, I know that I bother my opponents. It's nothing intentional, she said, and sometimes I'm glad when the umpire warns me. Oh, sure. This is going to be tough on Henin-Ardenne because she is someone like Steffi Graf who likes to play fast, 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 play quick points. Now, when the point begins, of course, Mary Pierce will want them to be short. She's a big hitter, and she doesn't want to do a lot of running. And Henin-Ardenne wants her to run.
The men's final will pit Mariano Puerta of Argentina against Rafael Nadal. Now, Nadal beat the number one seed, Roger Federer, yesterday to gain the final. I wonder if he feels as if he's already played for the championship.
You know, everybody looked on this as the championship match. This was called Championship Friday. Because it was Federer and Nadal, and it was a pity that they were on the same side of the draw, but that's the way it came out, and Nadal made Federer look very bad. His top spin, his movement, his speed, his competitiveness forced Federer to play some of his worst tennis. He was a little anxious. He served badly. His forehand, which is his best shot, didn't go very well at all, and he was quite calm after the whole thing. He said he wasn't going to tear up any locker rooms. He was looking forward to Wimbledon. But he acknowledged that playing Nadal with his left-handed spin is something that he's going to have to do a lot more of to get used to it.
But you have written that Mr. Puerta's greatest strength is that he can run all day and then some, but will that be enough to make a match of the final?
Well, he probably won't have to run all day because they won't be out there that long. But I hope it's a good match. It's the first time two left-handers have met since 1946. In fact, it's only happened once in the 80 years of the tournament. That's when a guy named Marcel Bernard, one of the rare Frenchmen to win it in recent years, beat Yaroslav Drobny from Czechoslovakia at the time. So I give this guy, this guy's ranked 37th. He's had so many problems. He nearly got killed when an elevator he was riding in, cable snapped. He had a drug suspension of 9 months. That cut him down to 400 and some in the rankings, and he's been working hard to get back. He's a second-string Argentine, there's no doubt about that, but the way he's been playing is very inspirational. He was up against the Russian Davidenko, And he came back from 2-1 down, and that's what he's been doing. He's been running, 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 and running his opponents out of the ballpark.
Does Puerta's success qualify him as once again a rising player, or is this something that's kind of a fluke particular to the French tournament?
Well, it's hard to say because at number 37, he doesn't belong in the final probably, but that's part of the fun. When you get a major championship, you've got 128 people in it, and you've got to win 7 rounds to do it. Well, that's a tough assignment, and sometimes some mystery guys come through, like Puerta.
But I've read that the crowds at the Open this year have been even more partisan than normal. Patty Schnieder complained that whenever she hit a good shot in her match against Mary Pierce, quote, it felt just like a funeral.
A funeral, yeah.
And then the match between the Frenchman Sebastian Grosjean and Spaniard Rafael Nadal was halted for nearly 10 minutes by the antics of the crowd. Will everybody behave at the women's final?
It just depends, I suppose. They like both players, and Ardenne, since she speaks French, since she's a former champion, I don't think they're going to gang up on her. But they certainly did on Svetlana Kuznetsova when she played in Ardenne. It was a funeral whenever she won a point, and the people cheered her mistakes wildly. But let's look at it this way. The French haven't done too well at their own championship. Mary Pierce is the only one to win since Françoise Dürr in 1967. And Yannick Noah in 1983. So I excuse them that. They don't throw things. They used to do that in Rome when people were playing against Italians, and Bjorn Borg said he'd never come back after being showered with coins. He was very young then. I thought he'd pick them up and put them in the bank, but he didn't do that.
Finally, Bud, yesterday Martina Navratilova came within a set of winning her 59th major title. She and Leander Paes lost in the final of the mixed doubles tournament. What is the matter with the kids on the other side of the net that they didn't show the 48-year-old some respect?
They don't show her much respect. And in fact, there are two ways they look at Martina. They say, what in the world is she doing around here? Why doesn't she get a real job? Or they're awed by her name and the fact that she plays doubles better than 99% of them. So I'm sorry she lost, frankly, because I like to see her play doubles. She's going to be playing for the Boston Lobsters in World Team Tennis in July. She's a treat to watch because she understands doubles, which is pretty much a lost art.
Well, I know there's not supposed to be any cheering in the press box, but I can imagine that you couldn't help rooting for her.
I had to restrain myself.
If you did, it's the first time. But anyway.
Yes, a record.
Bud Collins writes about tennis for the Boston Globe and joins me from time to time here on Only a Game. Thank you, Bud.
Thank you, Bill.
The hokey exuberance of the public address announcer at Gillette Stadium felt less forced than it might have last Saturday night. The home team, the New England Revolution, had begun the season with 6 wins, 2 draws, and nary a loss. And on this particular evening, the Revs were playing the woeful Colorado Rapids, losers in 7 of their first 9 matches. The Rapids embraced the strategy often favored by struggling teams in road games. They packed the back, eschewing offense pretty much entirely, and played for the draw that would net them 1 point. Despite losing midfielder Guy Melamed to a second yellow card in the 80th minute and having to finish the match a man down, the Rapids were able to execute their plan and force a 0-0 draw. In the press conference following the match, Revolution head coach Steve Nichol expressed some disappointment at that result. But when he was asked whether he'd ever have guessed that his club would be undefeated after 10 games, he managed a smile.
No, I'd be lying if I said I did, but it's kind of strange that we're a wee bit disappointed to only get a point. I think that's a good situation for the team to be in.
Good situation is the understatement of the decade where the Revolution is concerned. Even under Nichol, the most successful of the 5 head coaches the team has employed in 9 years, New England has never started strong, even in the seasons when the Revs have finished well. But not only is New England currently riding a 9-game undefeated streak, they have not allowed a goal at Gillette and have given up only 7 goals in 9 games. At practice on Tuesday morning, Jay Heaps, who started his career in Miami in 1999 and joined the Revolution during the 2001 season, talked about why the members of this year's team are working so well together.
Well, I think it's an understanding of who we have and what our capabilities are as players. You know, sometimes it takes a little while, but what Steve Nichol and our management have done, they've kept the guys around, a core group of guys. So we're really, rather than starting, you know, learning the personalities on the field and off the field, we know that. We know each other, and it's easy to build from rather than start fresh every year.
Keeping a core group of players together represents a challenge in pro soccer. Not only must the coaches consider the league's salary cap and deal with player injuries and suspensions, they also know their most effective players may be tapped to serve on their national teams. The U.S. team plays World Cup qualifying matches against Costa Rica today and Panama next week, and Steve Nichol has lost 3 of his most valuable players, Clint Dempsey, Steve Ralston, and Pat Noonan, to those matches. I asked Steve Nichol at Tuesday's practice whether he'd be taking aside the players who'd be trying to fill the gaps to tell them what he expected, or whether a pep talk at this level would be superfluous.
It's a bit of both, to be honest. You know, they've been with us long enough. You know, everybody here has basically been here since the start of pre-season. So if they don't know what we're trying to do and what we're all about, then either they're dumb as bricks or they've been watching what's going on.
Among those watching what was going on at Tuesday's practice was Mike Burns, who played for the Revolution during the team's first 4 seasons, a stretch that netted the Revs only 1 playoff appearance. Burns recently returned to New England to become the team's director of soccer. As a veteran of the Revs' not-so-old and decidedly not very good days, he was delighted to discover a group characterized by the conviction that they could win anywhere against anyone.
It's safe to say that probably hasn't always been the case over the last 10 years. So for this group to have this kind of confidence, there's no reason why we don't approach every game like we're going to win it. And I think that's the mentality of this team, and it's a great mentality to have.
This evening, Revs fans will see if that mentality prevails against visiting Kansas City, who have lost 2 players to national team service, when New England hosts the Wizards in Foxborough, Massachusetts. It's 19 minutes. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Jason Giambi, the Baltimore Orioles, and the beauty of baseball. But first, during one more or less representative 4-year stretch in his career, Jim Braddock lost 16 of 26 fights. 5 months before he fought Max Baer for the heavyweight championship of the world, Ring magazine did not list Braddock among its top 19 contenders. Yet, according to sports writer extraordinaire Damon Runyon, Braddock became the most popular champion in the history of the game. Jeremy Schapp has written a biography of Braddock entitled Cinderella Man, James J. Braddock, Max Baer, and the Greatest Upset in Boxing History. Jeremy Schapp joins me now from New York. Mr. Schapp, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much, Bill. It's a pleasure.
Early in his career, Braddock broke his right hand, and because he didn't have enough money for a doctor, it never set properly. Braddock's manager, Joe Gould, after consulting with one Dr. Wilford Frelick, came up with an economical way for the fighter to get the hand set properly. Tell us that story.
Well, you know, it's a great story and not apocryphal. They go to Wilfred Frelick, who is this famous New York hand surgeon who has treated the hands of Jack Dempsey and Gene Tunney, the most valuable hands in the world. And he tells them that the hand is hopelessly broken, that it healed improperly from a recent break, and that the only way to fix it is to break it again, that he will break it and reset it, and then the hand will be good as new. The only problem is he wants to charge them more than $1,000 to do this, and $1,000 to Jim Braddock and Joe Gould might as well be $1,000,000. So Braddock has, the light bulb goes off in his head, and he says, well, Doc, what do you think? Could I just break my hand in the ring? And the doctor looks at him and says, well, I guess that would work, too. Just make sure you set it properly this time. And that's what Jim Braddock did. Unfortunately, it took him a couple of fights to find somebody whose skull was hard enough to break his hand against.
In 1929, Braddock fought Tommy Loughran, the light heavyweight champ. Was the characterization of Braddock's performance that day as a laughingstock accurate?
Yeah. He was terrible against Loughran, and he knew it. He I think that Loughran won 13 of the two rounds in the cards, and the fight really wasn't that close. Loughran never hurt Braddock physically, really, but he did permanent damage, you could say, to his psyche as a fighter. I mean, he so thoroughly outclassed Jim Braddock that he never truly recovered, at least until 4 years later when he started the comeback that would culminate in his fight for the heavyweight championship.
Braddock's decline following the loss to Tommy Loughran eventually found him signing up for relief in order to feed his family. Braddock's manager, Joe Gould, meantime, was selling what you call, quote, gadgets and radios door to door.
Yeah.
But had things not come to such a pass, I guess it's fair to say Braddock never would have become such a popular figure.
He wouldn't have become a popular figure. I mean, the entire basis of his popularity and the interest in the fight when he fights Max Baer for the heavyweight championship is his experience on relief, a welfare recipient at a time when tens of millions of his fellow Americans were also on welfare or were just about to go on welfare. Or relief, as they called it at the time, and also his experience having been someone who in the late 1920s, when he's fighting Tommy Loughran and his ilk, is one of the, you know, he's this 24-year-old guy with $30,000 in the bank. The future looks incredibly bright. Everything is within his grasp. And then the crash occurs in October. And he, as much as any famous American, really suffers through the crash, and his career goes into this simultaneous tailspin.
What were the most significant changes in Braddock, the boxer, between the fight he lost to Tommy Loughran and the heavyweight championship bout against Max Baer?
Well, that's what makes the story to me so compelling in part, is that he never would have developed what he needed to develop to become the champion had he not been forced into retirement in 1933, breaking his hand once again, being forced because he has no money in the bank to go work on the docks for $4 a day. He has no money for public or private transportation. He is walking everywhere up to 12 miles a day, 12, 15 miles a day to get to and from the docks from his house, looking for other work. He's working on the docks with a bum right hand, so suddenly he's forced to build up the strength in his left hand, which has always been basically a vestigial extremity, something that he could never really use. Finally, his left hand is developing. Finally, his right hand is getting 9 full months to heal because it's in a cast and he can't use it at all and he's not fighting. And he was a guy who was very slow. I mean, plodding doesn't begin to describe how slow he was at times. But finally, he's building up this leg strength and the stamina from all the walking. Now, if he had never lost the $30,000 in the crash, if his businesses, any one of them, had succeeded, he never would have been forced to do this kind of manual labor and walk around, and he never would have been the fighter who got into the ring in 1934 at the beginning of his comeback with all of these skills and physical qualities that he didn't previously have.
Max Baer was a big, strong guy who loved to entertain people and craved the approval of the crowd. To what extent was his failure to beat Jim Braddock the result of his recognition that when he and the challenger climbed into the ring on June 13, 1935, the crowd preferred Braddock?
Well, Max was a very complicated guy. He was very conflicted about boxing. He loved being the heavyweight champion of the world, but he didn't love fighting. He is, in so many ways, I think, the diametric opposite of Jim Braddock. Jim Braddock is this stolid overachiever. Max Baer is this enormously gifted guy who wasted his talents and who didn't respect the sport of boxing the way that Jim Braddock did. He's a guy who killed one man in the ring and probably contributed to the death of another man in the ring. And the memories of those fights haunted him for the rest of his life. And I think at least subconsciously, after those deaths, he always was reluctant to go all out against all but a few opponents who he somehow managed to build up some hatred for. And Jim Braddock was not one of those guys. First of all, like everybody else, he thought that Jim Braddock wasn't in his class, so he didn't respect him as an opponent. He respected him as a person, but not as an opponent. Second, he was really conflicted, and his training reflected that. I mean, perhaps no champion has ever trained for his first title defense as indifferently as Max Baer did in the spring of 1935.
Braddock lost his title the very next time he fought. He was no match for Joe Louis. And of that fight, you wrote, quote, "He lost like a champion. It was a cliche, but one that mattered to him." What does losing like a champion mean in this context, and what's the cost of losing that way?
The Max Baer triumph is why he's famous, is why he's in the Boxing Hall of Fame. It made him the champion. It's his legacy. But I think you learn more about him, actually, by his fight against Joe Louis, his first title defense. He's 32 years old. Joe Louis is 9 years younger than him. He's stronger. He's bigger. He's only lost one fight to Max Schmeling, and that was a year before, and he is very eager to make up for that in the eyes of the public. Jim Braddock hadn't fought in 2 years since he won the title, and he knocks Louis down in the first round, but after that, Louis bounces right back up, and after that, it's a slaughter. And after the sixth round, Braddock's trusty manager, Joe Gould, says, "I'm throwing in the towel, Jim. It's all over." And Braddock says, "If you throw in the towel, Joe, I will never talk to you again." And he meant it. And he goes out there and he insists on losing his title on his back on the canvas. And, I mean, Louis just chops him to pieces in the eighth round. But to him, that's the way he wanted to go out. That's the way he wanted to give up the championship.
Jeremy, anybody who watches television has seen the trailer for The Cinderella Man, the movie based on Jim Braddock's career, at least 1,100 times.
I hope so.
And I should mention that your book and the movie, is there any connection at all?
There is no connection. I mean, there is a connection in the sense that I was aware that they were making a movie about Jim Braddock, and that certainly helped generate interest on the part of publishers, and it was something that I knew would help generate interest in readers. But they've been working on this movie a lot longer than I was working on the book, and I had a chance to see it recently. It's a great movie. It tells a different story than the book. The movie is much more focused on his family life, and the book is much more focused on his career. But it's a wonderful movie, and obviously I'm its biggest fan.
Jeremy Schaff is the author of Cinderella Man, James J. Braddock, Max Baer, and the Greatest Upset in Boxing History. He joined me from New York. Jeremy, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Bill.
The Kansas City Royals have the worst record in the American League, but there was joy in that particular Mudville this week. On Thursday night, the Royals completed an unlikely sweep of the New York Yankees. That hadn't happened in 15 years. Joining me now on the line to discuss the hard-charging Royals and other baseball matters is ESPN's Tim Kirkjian. Tim, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill.
Was there anything in Royals manager Buddy Bell's resume to indicate that he would be such a genius when he took over in Kansas City?
Actually, no. And if you look at Buddy's resume, it's not too good.
No,
Detroit,
I know.
Colorado, not good. But to defend him, and this is easy to do, those were terrible losing situations in Detroit and Colorado. Nobody could have won with those teams. It was unfair, and you cannot look at his record. I think he's perfect for the Royals, given that he's the guy who's going to walk in there, and if there are any young kids on that team who feel like they're just entitled to be in the big leagues and they don't care whether they win, they just want to run up their numbers and establish their careers, that will end with Buddy Bell, believe me. And if there are any veterans on that team who are just going through the motions because the team stinks, that will end also. Now, having said that, Bill, this is a bad Royals team. Even Buddy is not going to be able to resurrect them. But in the ultimate, of course, beauty of the game, the Yankees roll in there and get swept by the Royals. And now we know that's the third time in the history of the Yankees that they have lost a three-game series, been swept by a team that had the worst record in baseball at the time.
All right, Tim, let's talk about the two teams with the best records in the American League, the Boston Red Sox and the New York... Wait a minute. It's the Chicago White Sox and the Baltimore Orioles, just as you predicted, right?
Well, Bill, again, we laugh about my predictions and how often I'm wrong, and that's why I do what I do, because the game is so unpredictable. That's the best part about it. Now, on the White Sox, a friend of mine with the White Sox told me right before the season began, we're going to win the division. And he's the first guy to tell me we are terrible. So I listened to him, but I didn't listen hard enough, and I did not see them being this good. Jim Palmer of the Orioles told me the Orioles will win 90 games this year. This is before the season began. Buck Martinez said the Orioles are going to make the playoffs. And I kind of looked at him and said, you guys have to be kidding me. And here they are in first place with a variety of injuries also. Now, the key for them is, can they get Brian Roberts healthy here quickly? If he's in deep trouble here and he's going to be out for a while, given how good he has been, I'm not sure they can hang on. But they have done way better than I thought, and they are way better than I thought they were going to be.
The White Sox are particularly interesting, I think, because they found success via what's reminiscent of the go-go White Sox of the 50s. Can playing like that take a team to the playoffs in 2005?
Well, I think it can because they are so unusual compared to everybody else. We are in a power era now, Bill, as you know, where everybody just sits and waits for someone to hit a three-run homer. And the White Sox have decided we're going to put people in motion, but most important, we're going to out-pitch everybody, and that's exactly what they have done. Their starters' ERA is so much better than any other team in the American League. That's why the White Sox are where they are, and it doesn't matter if they hit homers or steal bases. If they get starting pitching like they've gotten the first third of this season, they're going to win the division, and I don't know anybody who picked them to win the division other than my one friend with the White Sox.
Another team that's learned how to win without the long ball is San Diego. Are you surprised that Los Angeles, San Francisco, Arizona at all have fallen behind the Padres?
Well, I am surprised by the Padres. I just saw them last week in San Diego, and they are much better than I thought they were going to be. Their bullpen is the deepest in the National League, according to Bobby Cox, the Braves manager. Their bench is extremely deep. They're no longer spooked, Bill, by the largeness of their ballpark. Last year, Ryan Klesko, Phil Nevin, Brian Giles were all just upset all the time that their park was so big they couldn't hit any home runs there. Well, this year, Bruce Bochy, their manager, basically said, fellas, no more complaining about the ballpark. This is going to work to our advantage, not our disadvantage. And so far, they are past that. And at this point, I think they are the team to beat for sure in the National League West. And believe me, 3 weeks ago, I didn't believe that.
Tim, how much has the steroid testing program played a role in the success of the way teams like the White Sox and the Padres are playing?
Well, I think the really smart teams out there really looked down the road and said, you know what, guys have been getting smaller the last 2 years, and they're going to continue to get smaller, which means we're going to continue to lose the power production, which is clear this year, and it's going to keep going because, you know, Congress and Major League Baseball is not fooling around with this testing, and guys are going to continue to get off of this. So in theory, runs are going to go down as they have this year. Homers are going to go down as they have this year. And we might as well start building in another way. You know, let's pitch it better. Let's run better. Let's catch it better instead of sitting back and waiting for homers, because the homers are going to go down. They're not going to go up.
Nike ended its relationship with New York Yankee first baseman Jason Giambi this week. Nike's only the most recent corporation to go that route. I wonder if the potential loss of millions of dollars might be a more effective deterrent than steroid testing.
I think people are going to look and see what's happened to Jason Giambi and say, you know, I really don't want that to happen to me. And I think that will be, like you said, the biggest deterrent. He's not going to lose a whole lot of money over this as far as the actual playing of the game. But when you start to lose endorsement money like he's going to lose, I think that's what people look at, players look at. And I also think, Bill, they look at the embarrassment as what has happened to Jason Giambi. And you know, players, a lot of them are rich enough that they could lose a lot of money, and it doesn't affect them. I think that the biggest deterrent will be embarrassed publicly, and that's what's happened ultimately to Jason Giambi, being named in this, playing poorly through this, being booed over this, and no player wants any part of that.
Tim Kirkjian covers baseball for ESPN and ESPN the magazine. Tim, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure, Bill.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. please let us know on which station you hear Only a Game and how to pronounce your name. You can leave comments on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. You can visit Only a Game's website at www.onlyagame.org. But anyway, it's a rain delay. It's a rain delay. 'Cause it's a rain delay. I'm sorry, okay. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, Bicon.com. And from the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at CabotCheese.com.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, Total Immersion, Besubaru comes to Arizona. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
The man who was Bill Russell before Bill Russell, Kareem before Kareem, and Shaq before Shaq, George Mikan, died this week, Charlie. He was 80 years old. How many players will be remembered as so good that they forced those running the game to change the rules?
Well, only a couple. Bill Russell, Wilt Chamberlain, and at least in college, the then Lou Alcindor.
Mm-hmm.
Among his other exploits was being president of the ABA and inventing the red, white, the famous red, white, and blue basketball. What I always thought about what was cool about George Mikan was not just the fact that he was named the player of basketball's first 50 years, the player of the first half century, but the glasses. He was such an inspiration to any little geeky kid like me who had to wear funny-looking glasses when they were a kid.
Absolutely.
Because he didn't wear, you know, wraparound sports specs or contact lenses. He wrote those little, those really tiny kind of rimless John Lennon librarian glasses.
The Miami Heat lead the Detroit Pistons 3-2 in the NBA's Eastern Conference Finals. Pistons head coach Larry Brown may be the future president of the Cleveland Cavaliers. This sort of speculation can't be good for team morale. Why didn't the parties involved wait for the playoffs to end before starting these negotiations?
Because don't underestimate the vast reservoir of newfound idiocy that Cleveland has found in its owner, Dan Gilbert. This guy bears watching because this guy is Mark Cuban except without the natural diffidence.
Just to return to the Larry Brown side of this for a moment, do you suppose that he really told two people in the NBA that he was going to take the job in Cleveland and didn't anticipate the news would somehow get out?
I think he probably told 12 people in the NBA that he was taking the job in Cleveland and anticipated the news was coming out. I have no doubt he probably told people he was going to be chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Larry Brown, on the subject of his employment, is a complete neurotic.
The San Antonio Spurs await their Eastern Conference foe, having beaten the Phoenix Suns 4-1 in the Western Conference Finals. But what about the theory that Amari Stoudemire of the Suns was the biggest winner in that series?
I think in terms of the future of the NBA, he was. This was a very, very substantial coming-out party for him. He proved he could play, nay, outplay Tim Duncan, and outside of a healthy Shaquille O'Neal, there's nobody better at his position. He vaulted himself into somewhere in the top five players in the league.
Elsewhere in basketball news, would you care to update our listeners who've been wondering what former NBA great Dennis Rodman has been up to?
Well, I suppose I have to, since no one else is likely to. He has entered himself in the 2005 Wife Carrying World Championships, which take place in, and I love it, Sukajärvi in Finland. It's a 250-yard race in which the wife, which is in quotes in the Wired dispatch, I might add, rides upside down on the runner's back with her legs slung over his shoulders for maximum speed. I think we can safely say that this is probably only the fourth or fifth strangest thing Dennis Rodman's ever done in his life.
The Green Bay Packers announced this week that at their home opener on September 18th, the team will retire the jersey of Reggie White. I was surprised to read that only four other former Packers have received that distinction. What about you?
Well, we're a little bit spoiled here by the profligacy with which the Boston Celtics retire numbers. I think they're into triple digits at this point. Only Tony Canadeo, Don Hudson, Bart Starr, and Ray Nitschke have had their numbers retired. Apparently, Reggie White was informed of this prior to passing away last December, so I think there's something to be thankful for there.
The San Francisco 49ers made the news this week as well, but they wish they hadn't. Discuss.
I have no idea what they were thinking. I certainly have no idea what PR director Kirk Reynolds was thinking. They put together a 15-minute film to prepare the San Francisco 49er players for dealing with the media. The film contained racist jokes, topless blondes, lesbian softcore pornography, and impersonation of various city officials, including the mayor. Now, I don't really know what kind of press corps they have in San Francisco these days, but I don't really see what kind of function this serves. If there's one town in America, one town in Major League Sports, where you don't want to make this kind of idiotic blunder, it's San Francisco. And, of course, the 49ers have been backing and filling and crawfishing ever since.
And firing the guy who was
responsible
for
the
video.
And firing the guy who was responsible, exactly.
England's national team played a couple of friendly matches in the U.S. going 2-0, and David Beckham has set hearts a-fluttering by suggesting that he may play in MLS at some point in his career. The question is, can MLS afford to wait until Bex is, 70, 75 years old?
Well, you're the soccer guy here. I mean, would this be more than having Pele come over and play for the Cosmos for the purposes of ginning up the league?
From a spectacularly celebrity point of view, yeah. I think it probably would be. But from a pure soccer point of view, I think the great part of this story is Beckham would be taking the largest salary cut in the history of professional sports.
Well, I just think that the one thing the MLS has done right has been to find its niche, play in its niche, sell itself on its own terms. This just seems to me like a grab for the spotlight that's very un-MLS.
Nike announced this week that Jason Giambi, quote, no longer has a relationship, end quote, with the offshore sneaker giant. Do you suppose it's the steroid connection that's responsible for the split or the fact that Giambi is currently hitting about 230?
Well, depending on how much you attribute the fact that he's hitting 234 to the fact that he's not doing the juice he said he was doing, then the steroid thing has or has not a limited. It's certainly the lack of success, because Nike wouldn't care if you ate human flesh if you hit 350 and could sell shoes.
I guess ballpark nuptials were bound to fall out of vogue, but could you have anticipated the type of sports-related marriage in the news this week?
Two Nepalese people from different tribes, by the way, which was a big deal in Nepal, got married on top of Mount Everest. Moni Mulapati and Pem Dorji, they briefly took off their oxygen masks and put on plastic garlands while the groom put the traditional red powder on the bride's forehead, symbolizing marriage. And then the wedding band struck up, feelings.
And finally, Charlie, the Jockey Club, the organization that has to okay names for thoroughbreds, has turned thumbs down on Garrett Redman, the owner of Ballycapel, a farm in Paris. Mr. Redman wanted to name his horse Sally Hemings, and he says that he would be honoring Sally Hemings by doing so. What do you think?
I don't know. All I know is that the only person that was contacted for the story who's related to Madison Hemings, the son of Sally Hemings and allegedly Thomas Jefferson, said he thought the whole thing sounded absolutely ridiculous. I realize this is all just a terrible historical can of worms, but there's a certain logic to it since the filly is out of the colonial affair mare named Jefferson Secret.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me for his weekly constitutional on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Rejoice, Columbia sons, rejoice, the tyrants never bend the knee, but join with heart, with soul and voice for Jefferson and liberty.
Lynn French, who hears Only a Game on KJZZ in Phoenix, sent us a thank you note in reference to Karen Given's story, which ran on last week's show. It was great to hear your story about roller derby, Ms. French wrote, but I must take exception with a reporter saying not much skating goes on. I've been skating with the Arizona Roller Derby since the beginning of the year. During an average 2.5-minute jam, we will skate an average of 18 laps, and our fastest jammer, Helen Wheels, will push 30 laps. That email is signed French Lick, number 11, Bruisers. Steve Roach, a WBUR listener, was also moved to write by the roller derby story. I love your show, but something was lacking today, he opined. Roller derby? No mention of the performance by a fleet Alex who nearly went to his knees and then went on to win the Preakness? Come on! Jim Hawley emailed from Louisville, Kentucky to say, thanks for the nice piece on Chico Carrasquel. I remember going to Comiskey Park with my father to see the White Sox featuring Chico and Minnie Minoso. I especially remember my father's great amusement when an early TV announcer referred to Chico Carrasquel as the man with four K's in his name. Of my conversation in last week's program with Miami basketball writer Dan Le Batard, Tim Otterson, who hears Only a Game on WBFO in Buffalo, wrote, I have to wonder if Dan watched the first two Suns-Spurs games. He accuses the Spurs of playing boring, slowed-down defensive basketball. They averaged 116 points a game and shot over 70% in the fourth period. That sounds pretty exciting to me. And finally, Ethan Settle, a student at Roxbury Latin School in Boston, emailed recently because he and a friend have been arguing over whether Ted Williams was a Red Sox or a Red Sox. And the dispute has, in Mr. Settle's words, become quite heated and involved almost the whole school. I've puzzled over this one since moving to Boston in 1972. Since both designations sound wrong, I generally write Williams, who played for the Red Sox, and so on. Ethan, I apologize for the cop-out. Your comments, corrections, and questions will reach us through our website, onlyagame.org. Our addresses are onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu and onlyagame, WBUR 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. You can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. The Golden Baseball League has begun its inaugural season with 8 teams playing in California and Arizona. Until recently, the San Diego Surfdogs had led this minor league in notoriety. They signed 46-year-old outfielder Ricky Henderson. But the team that may soon attract the most attention features a roster that's entirely foreign to stateside fans. Arizona Public Radio's Mitch Tyke reports.
The Samurai Bears will spend a lot of time on the bus this season. That's because they're the Japan Samurai Bears, and every one of their 90 games will be played on the road. For many of the players, it's their first ever trip stateside, and it'll include stops in such literal hotspots as Yuma and Surprise, Arizona. Even so, the experience is a dream come true for 23-year-old pitcher Rentaro Seki.
You know, the grassy fields and the overall environment of the minor league system or the baseball system in America is something I really like. And I think that, so, yeah, you know, when I'm standing on the line and I hear the American national anthem, I really get the feeling that I am in America.
For Seki and many of his teammates, playing professional ball is a dream come true. They'd be good enough to play minor league baseball back in Japan if there was minor league baseball in Japan. Dave Cavill, founder and CEO of the Golden Baseball League, says that was a key reason for creating the Samurai Bears.
In Japan right now, there are very few opportunities to play professional baseball. There's an A team and a B team of every professional team, but that's it. And, you know, thousands of kids are basically shot out of the system every year. And because of that, there's nowhere for these kids to go. They've been going to Australia, and they've been going to China, and we really felt that there was a way to incorporate them into a U.S. professional league.
In order to entice 25 young Japanese players to spend a summer playing ball in the hot sun of Arizona and California, Cavill and the GBL wanted to make an experience that transcends international borders. They started by finding the right manager. Warren Cromartie played 9 seasons for the Montreal Expos before he went to Japan and became one of the most successful and well-liked Westerners ever to play there, even earning his own theme song. Takanori Yamamoto, a former Japanese major league pitcher and now a baseball TV commentator there, says Cromartie was the perfect choice.
He is Japanese.
You know, when he played in Japan, he was the most Japanese out of the foreigners who came and played in Japan. So even among the players on this team, he is very much very good friends with many of these players.
Even Warren Cromartie himself thinks he's the perfect man for the job. In his 7 years with the Yomiuri Giants, Cromartie became proficient in the Japanese style of play. Most Americans would know it as small ball, which emphasizes the bunt and hit and run more than power hitting. It's a habit Cromartie's been trying to break since the second night of the season. After his leadoff man reached base, the next hitter automatically laid down a bunt.
In Japan, there's no strategy, there's no element of surprise. Everything is predictable over there. So I got him when I got him and put him over to the side and said, listen, when the runner's on first base, I want you to try to pull the ball in the hole. I don't like giving away outs early in the ball game. He was surprised to hear that because that's what the model that he came from in Japan. So the rest of the season, he won't do that. He understands the type of style that I'm trying to imprint. It actually gives him a little bit more confidence to swing the bat.
But even as Cromartie tries to de-emphasize the Japanese style of playing baseball, the Golden Baseball League is trying to emphasize the Japanese style of watching baseball. In addition to traditional taiko drumming and music, the pregame ceremonies at the Samurai Bears opening series in Surprise featured Japanese player introductions and the national anthem of Japan. Players who hit a home run receive teddy bears when they cross home plate, as they would back home, and during the seventh inning stretch, fans first sing Take Me Out to the Ball Game, then release hundreds of colorful noise-making balloons called Jetto Fusen, a tradition started by the Hanshin Tigers of the Japanese Central League. Golden Baseball League founder Dave Cavill says these Japanese touches help the Bears feel more at home and are fun for the fans, too.
You know, we really wanted to make this a cultural exchange. You know, it's the 100th anniversary of the first all-Japanese team to play in the United States back in 1905. Well, I think what it does is provide a nice, different, and unique entertainment option for fans in the United States.
In each of the cities where the Samurai Bears will play, Cavill says team members will make appearances at local Japanese chambers of commerce, and the league will make an effort to attract Japanese Americans to the ballpark. In Surprise, one of those fans was Motoko Suzuki, who watched Warren Cromartie play in Tokyo and sought out his autograph in Surprise. She thinks the players appreciate the effort to make Arizona feel more like Japan, but says that's not the only benefit to playing in the GBL.
They must be happy, all of them. This circumstances is much better than Japan, and they always play with American player. It's better for them to progress.
There are clearly some things about the GBL that are foreign to the Japanese players. Opening night in Surprise was Pat Sajak bobblehead night, a concept that may not have translated especially well. Many of the players say they're not used to American fast food, which has less rice than they're used to. And while learning English isn't a priority on a team with all Japanese players, manager Warren Cromartie believes playing baseball is never really lost in translation anyway.
You know, baseball is the same all over the world. The distance between home and first base is the same. The distance between the mound and home is the same. So you can put nine guys from different nationalities on a baseball team, who a couple of rednecks, blacks, Chinese, Japanese, whatever you want. Bottom line, once they cross the line, it's baseball.
Like with all independent minor league teams, the Samurai Bears will be a success if any of their players are picked up by a team like the Giants, San Francisco, or Tokyo. For Only a Game, I'm Mitch Teich in Surprise, Arizona.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help from Tom Hanks at Splash Studios in New York. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to learn more about Cinderella Man, browse Only a Game's show archive, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Bud Collins, currently enjoying the French Open in Paris. Ah, never mind, Bud. Enjoy your palm frites or palm freedoms or whatever the heck they're called now. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, from NPR member stations, from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org, and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.